Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The center of innovation is here. And, you know, this is part of the message of Project Kazimierz, of this whole podcast, that there's something happening here which is beyond just good value for money.
Like I said, having the vision is great, but the key is these concrete initiatives that drive it at the ground level.
I think Poland owes people who are really, they do extremely well with very limited resources, and we can take advantage of the really low costs here.
You know, Poland is the land of opportunity, and I like to say the East is the new West, because you always used to go West in history to find more adventure and danger and prove yourself.
There are some good things beginning to happen here in Krakow, but we've got a very long way to go.
Good evening, good morning, good night, whatever time of day it is, Project Kazimierz listeners. It's a great pleasure today to have on the show Adam Davidson, who I could try to introduce to you now, but I think it possibly make more sense for you to introduce yourself the way you do would to anyone else if you just bumped into them at a business networking event or a party and they asked you, what do you do?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so I'm the CEO of Trident Resources, soon to be renamed Trident Royalties, which is a London exchange, a market listed mining royalty and streaming company. So we invest in royalties and streams across various geographies and across the breadth of mining commodities. So everything from gold and copper to iron ore and obscure stuff like mineral sands, it falls within our purview. So it's an investment company that gets exposure to cash flows from these various assets.
And you're speaking to us today from Denver, Colorado, is that correct?
Correct. Yeah. So despite myself being in Denver and with the London listing, we're a pretty dispersed team. So most of the board sits in the UK and I'm in Denver, just sort of a mining hub here in North America. And then my colleague is in Perth, Australia, which again is a mining hub for that side of the world.
That's right. And so as regular listeners know, the main themes of this podcast are the innovation, entrepreneurship, but also the entrepreneurial journey. And when I looked at your LinkedIn profile, which we'll post in the show notes, I saw you were a member of the, I think, the Australian Mining, the Australian Mining Federation, Australian, I'm just looking, you help me out here. Mm. There's some Australian mining body you're a member of.
Oh, the Institute of Company Directors. Oh,
that's right. And I thought to start with your Australian, but in fact, are you an out and out American? Is that correct?
I am. Yeah, I spent a few years down in Perth, but yeah, based in Denver for the last sort of 10 years or so.
Okay. So that was just, and I think it's because of the first link I clicked on when I was researching Trident was took me to the Perth office, and I thought, ah. And I think wasn't your first major deal in Australia? Was that correct?
Exactly. Yeah. Our first transaction was over an iron ore mine in Australia, in Western Australia. And we're finding quite a few opportunities in Australia. So yeah, we've definitely got a focus on that side of the world.
Okay. And I came across you as a result of the business you lead going public and being listed on the stock exchange in the UK. But before we get to that part of your story, I'm always interested in the what I call the entrepreneurial journey. And I know that prior to this, you were working in a private equity business. But when you were growing up in America, did you think that one day you'd be the leader of your own a business? And did you see yourself as an entrepreneur, or is it something, because it's quite a step to step out of the warmth and comfort of a well-funded private equity to be doing what you're doing now? Did you have like clear expectations of the way your life would go, and are you doing what your family expected of you, or is this a bit of a surprise for them?
Perhaps a bit of a surprise for them, but not necessarily for myself. I think I've always had sort of the entrepreneurial bug. And so it's actually a bit counterintuitive for myself. So I've always generally worked for large organizations up until now, where you did have that comfort of, of having a pretty clear runway in front of you. But yeah, it got to the stage where I was very much ready to do something more entrepreneurial. So when the opportunity presented itself, I couldn't help myself, had to make the jump.
And that's a very interesting fact, that quite often if you talk to people who've like in business on their own account, is something that they could barely stop themselves from doing when the opportunity was there, that they're sort of ready for it. And but as a teenager, if we go back, like, I know we can talk about your education, your school and stuff, but when you were like a teenager or a kid, you obviously didn't go straight into business because you worked for larger organizations, but did you see yourself having your own business one day? Was that always there at the back of your mind, or did it gradually evolve over time?
Yeah, I've always had the personal mantra that you can only go but so far working for other people. So I guess that was always very conscious of it. But I think, and then, sort of a circuitous path to get to where I am. But I think that was always something I was very conscious of and was sort of striving towards. It's just, a matter of sort of building up your experience to the point where I was comfortable making the move. You can obviously make that sort of move too early, and not that failure is not a good education, but didn't want to fail. So I wanted to make sure I got the sort of education experience I needed before embarking on something like this. But I think we've managed to step things out on the right foot and have it's not just me, obviously. I have a supportive board and as I mentioned, my colleague in Perth and expanding team. So I think, very much a group of like-minded people all striving in the right direction sets us up really well for success.
Okay. And you were in private equity in doing finance in resources, and did that actually influence you in the sense that one of the things that private equity does is put you into contact with entrepreneurs? And did you look at the people you were funding and get in some way inspired by them? Was that part of the story?
Yeah, it's hard not to come across some of these companies and think to yourself, it would be really exciting to be part of that. We're helping finance it, but they're the ones doing it. So you're sort of one step removed from the really exciting part. So yeah, I think that played a role as well. And when you look at the broader team and Trident, our chairman, James Kelly, he was with Xstrata, later Glencore, so big mining companies, but then he became part of the founding team of Greenstone Resources, which is a mining focused private equity fund based in the UK. Mark Potter was the CIO of Anglo Pacific, which is a big mining royalty company listed in the UK, the only other mining royalty company aside from us listed in the UK, and is now the CIO of Metal Tiger. So a smaller cap mining investment vehicle, and obviously on the board of Trident. So I think all of us share a similar mindset in that regard, that we were excited by the niche that we've identified in the market and it seemed to be panning out because we're executing on deals. We've raised the financing we need. So everything's sort of full steam ahead, but very much a group of like-minded people in that regard.
And there's a lesson, part of this is sort of education. There's a lesson to be drawn as well, that the startup community, which I'm quite connected to here, is very often a little bit obsessed by the idea of the young entrepreneur and sometimes criticized for that reason, rightly or wrongly. And I don't think you'll be angry with me for saying you're 37 years old, because that was published information, right?
Yeah, 38 now. So yeah, I don't know if I can classify myself as young, but not too seasoned. So somewhere in between, hopefully.
Not too seasoned, but we had on the podcast a couple of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, Matt Clifford, who was the founder of and leads something called Entrepreneur First, which is a talent-based accelerator based in the UK. And he was saying that the average age of the people joining the program had gone above 40. And to begin with, everyone saw it was a young person thing. And in fact, very often that can be part of the edge of going into business, the fact that you've got maybe a few things under your belt that make it more likely you'll succeed. And, you know, I think I know the answer to this question, but you might surprise me. What would you think are the things you've learned working for other people that help you believe that what you're doing now is going to be successful?
I've worked for a couple of places now where it was effectively set up by people with an entrepreneurial focus. So, you know, seeing their success and the way they navigated through it was pretty educational, and in some cases pretty inspiring, because you can see that these things are achievable. And whereas you don't necessarily get that at a larger organization where you're very much removed from the team that has set it up, or if in fact it's been set up sort of decades in advance. So I think it's educational from the perspective of you see how they're navigating the building of a business, and then it leaves you with a bit of enthusiasm to try to develop your own concept. So I think that was a pretty critical part of the pathway for me towards Triton.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask you to go again through what the business does. It's in natural resources, and I know this already, but was there something about natural resources, mining, quarrying, that type of business that attracted you? Because that's what you were financing when you were in private equity as well. Was there something about that area of commercial enterprise that attracted you?
Yeah, so my background is in mining, and even prior to working in private equity in the mining space, prior to that, I was in equity research at BMO, so one of the big Canadian mining focused banks, covering metals and mining, and part of that was with Orica Mining and strategic planning. So that's the industry that I'm in, and it's an industry that in some ways obviously is old as time and cannot feel very entrepreneurial or like there's much excitement there relative to tech or other things like that, but there's actually quite a bit of opportunity because it's a very cyclical sort of industry. Right now gold is very hot because there's a lot of uncertainty in the world, but because industry in general is down, things like base metals and bulk commodities like iron ore, they're not as hot, and so there are opportunities to invest in that sector because they will have their day as well, and so there's opportunity for upswing. And gold, no doubt, will taper at some point again, and there'll be opportunities in gold. So it's a pretty dynamic sort of industry when you look into it. And each commodity is its own sort of little world with different supply-demand dynamics. So it's actually, people sort of think of mining as being digging up rocks and crushing them up and extracting the minerals and relatively straightforward and unexciting. But there's actually quite a bit going on. And it ties in with, what's going on in the macro world. COVID is impacting mining, as you'd expect, in a significant way, as well as sort of, when you get down to the asset level, very much, you're looking at the micro aspects of the communities living nearby and how they can impact an operation or how the operation is impacting them. So it's a pretty dynamic industry and a lot of opportunity. And as you said, we can talk to what we're doing specifically in the space, but in a moment, but effectively what we saw is there was a gap in the financing market of mining operations, and it's because it is a developing and evolving world on that side of things. So it's an industry that's not overly crowded in that regard, in the sense that even here in Denver, which is a bit of a mining hub for the U.S. You wouldn't bump into very many people in the mining industry relative to tech. So there are a lot of opportunities for entrepreneurial minded people to find niches and opportunities to exploit.
Yes, this is going to be the last question about your background, because I sense that what you really want to do is to talk about the business, which I also want to talk about. But yeah. You said your background was in mining, but was there a time, like, I don't know, maybe when you were 16, 18, around that stage in your life where you thought, this is what I want to do, that sort of, was there some pull? Because mining's a mixture of financing and technology and engineering. And I don't know whether you get these massive machines and, you know, huge projects. And what do you know why you decided to go down that path? Like, imagine you've got a four-year-old asking you, why did you decide to do what you did? Or at the end of your life, you're in front of the pearly gates, and if they exist, and like, what was it about mining that attracted you?
I mean, it's pretty awe-inspiring if you go to some of these operations, you know, that are just massive equipment, you know, a massive engineering feat. So I've always been pretty excited about mining. And then coupled with that, my background is finance as well, and very much a bit of a math nerd. And marrying up the two was sort of a natural fit for me. So I feel like I've sort of landed right where I should, really.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because I'm significantly older than you. I'm 54, and I have to say, I really don't know. And I've done many different businesses, and I'm still wondering what my thing will be. it's the excitement to bring something new to fruition is the great thing. Something that didn't exist before does exist. And I know some of my listeners will be wondering, is he going to ask any questions about that? And I know that Trident doesn't do thermal coal. What would you say to people who say you're evil? You shouldn't be doing what you do because natural resource extraction is wrong and you're damaging the planet. And, you know, I imagine that question does get asked from time to time. And I'm just curious
very occasionally. Yeah, there's an old saying in the mining industry that everything you touch has either been grown or mined. You pick up your phone and there's, you know, you can find some really neat infographics on all the minerals that are in your phone, everything from cobalt to silver and everything else. And you hop in your car and it's the same way. It took metallurgical coal and iron ore to make that steel and bauxite for the aluminum. You know, so it's it'd be a bit naive for people to sort of say we should halt mining, because it's a critical part of society and producing the things that we use. Now that there's a very clearly a right way and a wrong way to mine, and we're very much aligned with ensuring that we only invest in projects that are doing it the right way. I think everybody and the industry and as a whole is very conscious, you know, to the environmental and social sort of impacts of the mining operations.
Okay. And moving on to what the business does, you took me through this, but there are certain industries where royalties are a key part of it, and, you know, Hollywood, maybe licensing deals in pharmaceuticals, maybe publishers, but royalties in mining is probably something that not everyone's familiar with. And remember that not everyone listening is experienced in finance. So maybe kick off by explaining what a royalty is and then explain why they exist and why they're relevant to the mining industry.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, fortunately, they are pretty easy to explain to somebody who's not familiar with them, because we're not dealing with sort of complex derivatives or anything like that. It simply is you provide capital to the miner, and in exchange they give you a percentage of their revenue. So from an investor's perspective, if you're bullish on say copper, for example, we just completed a copper transaction. It's an ideal way to get your copper exposure, because your alternative is to invest directly in a miner that produces copper, but then you're getting bottom line exposure. You're exposed to all their costs along the way. And there are numerous occasions where the operator, you know, the underlying commodity price may tick up and you've gotten that call right, but then the operator goes out there and does M&A, or they expand their plant, or whatever the case may be. They chew up that capital, so you don't see it returning to you as an equity holder. Well, with the royalty, because you're getting a percentage of revenue, you're sitting at the top line. So if copper ticks up, then the percentage of the revenue ticks up, and your share of that revenue increases. So it's direct exposure. But it still retains the asset benefits. So if they do go out there and expand their plant or drill and find more copper, then that extends the mine life or increases production. And that again benefits revenue, which benefits your royalty, but you didn't have to pay for it. They're using equities money to do that. So it's got some real benefits from the investor standpoint. Now, why the miners would accept a royalty, it can be numerous reasons, but in some cases, either public equity is not available. You know, they can't go out in the equity markets. In a market like today, you may not be able to raise the money you need, or they may not want to raise at the share price and suffer the dilution. A royalty is obviously non-dilutive to equity. And relative to debt, it's covenant light. It only pays us when the asset is generating revenue. Whereas a debt instrument, you might have a fixed payment schedule and that sort of thing. So, there's a certain niche where it makes sense for both parties. And I suppose the real opportunity that we found is that it's increasingly being used. If you look at the peers in the space, it's pretty much focused on precious metals in North America, which is the genesis of the royalty model effectively in the mining space. But you'll see from our first two transactions, the first one is iron ore in Australia. The second one is a copper producer in Zambia. So those fall well and truly out of our peers' sort of purview. They incredibly accretive transactions, but they just they don't fit their investment mandate. So what we think we found is an opportunity to continue to exploit some of those potential transactions that. Really, you're not competing with the other royalty companies because they don't play in the space. You're competing with equity and debt. And there's always sort of a niche where a royalty would make sense.
Yeah. So for anyone listening thinking this is interesting, if you go to Trident Resources, all this will be, this is really for the benefit of the online viewers. One of our viewers in India, Jonah, a young man in Kerala province, is saying hi from India. So greetings back to you. And I think for some reason you muted yourself a moment ago.
Have a plane going by. So
thank you for that. So I'm just going to see if I can post a link in the chat channel. If anyone,
we're at tridentroyalties.com. So it's just change the name because we're in the process of changing from Trident Resources to Trident Royalties.
If you're listening on the podcast as opposed to the live broadcast now, you'll get the show notes and links to Adam. But one of the things about the business proposal from the people providing the capital is the question of how certain the project is to be successful. And I would imagine that the earlier you are in the life cycle of the mine project, the riskier it is, and therefore potentially the bigger the royalty share you would get. But in the case of what you're investing in, you tend to be investing in established projects that are already like on the way or already producing their product, right?
Yeah, so it does vary, and we're open to earlier stage stuff. We would make it a smaller ticket size with regards to the investment size. Because initially what we want to do is build up a portfolio with cash flow, because that unlocks a lot of things for us as a company, the ability to go out there and get debt to continue to buy royalties, which is cheaper cost of capital relative to equity, and the ability to pay a dividend down the track. So we are prioritizing cash flow, but we will do some earlier exploration and development stage assets. And there are a few ways you could structure around it. So the first royalty, because you're very much right, you're not exposed to the costs of the asset, but you are exposed in a binary way that if it shuts down, it stops generating revenue, you stop getting your share of revenue. So you do want to look for very defensive assets. So the first royalty we acquired was over an iron ore mine in Western Australia. So a good jurisdiction. It's operated by Mineral Resources, which is a major ASX listed miner and multi-billion dollar market cap miner. They've just allocated $120 million to expand this particular asset. So you've got an asset that's operating, it's selling into the market. So that's a known quantity operated by a major who's expanding it and allocating significant capital to it. So a very defensive asset, that could sort of has the wherewithal to survive some market turbulence if needed. And then using our second royalty that we just announced earlier this week, it's over a copper asset in Zambia that's just ramping up production now. They just shipped their first copper cathode just last month. That you would say that, and it's operated by a private company, a very good team, but a private company that doesn't have the same sort of balance sheet as MinRes. So the way we structured that one in particular was to help mitigate some of this risk was there's no minimum payments due this year. We're just paid our share of revenue. But then next year, we're paid a minimum of $375,000 per quarter. That increases to $500,000 per quarter in 2022. And then for the first two quarters of 2023, we're paid $750,000 per quarter. So at that point in time, we'll have recovered the $5 million that we invested. So it's effectively a maximum of 3 years before we recover our cost of capital. And then from there, the percentage of revenue that is attributable to us steps down from 1.25% to 0.3% for the remaining, foreseeable future. So royalties are very sort of straightforward vehicles, but there's a lot of nuance where you can structure around different risk profiles. So that's what we did in that case. So you can't sort of adjust to a certain extent.
So we just lost the last couple of seconds of that with a little glitch, but I think to summarize it back, you were saying that like each deal is structured a bit differently, but what you've raised an issue, you raised I think about $20 million in your first fundraising, which made me think immediately you're not going to have that many $5 million deals before you're out of capital. So and you mentioned equity, you mentioned debt, that obviously once you've got the cash flow coming in, you'll have I guess you'll have the asset against which you can borrow and the cash flow. But will you be going back to, as you've proven your ability to execute, will you be going back to different funds to raise more capital? Or because it's not that much. And for some of our listeners, 20 for you and your private bank account, that would be quite a lot of money. But in the mining industry, it's not a vast fortune.
No, that's right. I think the short answer is it'll largely be dictated by what we get into the portfolio. So, yeah, as I flagged on the copper royalty in Zambia, that has a minimum payment of $1.5 million next year, and that steps up to $2 million the following year. Our iron ore royalty in Australia, again, it's all dependent on prices of the underlying commodities and how much they produce and all that sort of thing. But we'd be quietly hopeful that would pay about $2 million US this year. So as you build up that revenue, and as we acquire subsequent royalties and can build up the revenue and, to the point where we're, generating sort of $5, $6, $7 million, that does then, it allows you to go to the debt providers, and rather than being viewed as one or two single assets that they're lending against, you're viewed as a portfolio of cash flowing financial instruments effectively. And we've had some of those initial discussions, the rough guidance is circa 2x of your pre-tax revenue is about what you can get in leverage, some cases more, some cases less. So really our intent is with this capital that we've raised to go out there and get some leverage so we can continue to build a portfolio. We wouldn't rule out a subsequent equity raise, but ideally we can build out the portfolio without suffering the dilution of continually going out there and raising money. Or if we were to raise it, we would want it to be obviously at a higher share price from our initial raise.
Yes, that's right. And these are things which may not make sense to someone who's early in their career, but usually people say raise as little as possible, as late as possible when it comes to equity.
That's right.
and then borrow as much as the markets will provide, particularly these days, because I suppose part of the argument for what you do is with interest rates being so spectacularly low, anything that generates a decent rate of return on capital is potentially very attractive to investors.
That's right. Yeah. And lenders can take security over the royalties, that they are, long life assets. They convey in most cases with the tenement or the mining license so that they sort of never go away. Even if the operation stops, the royalty is still over that ground in most cases. So it's the type of thing that banks and credit funds can lend against.
Good. And so coming back to what a royalty is, you explained it so well, I'm not going to repeat it, but I was describing this to a friend yesterday and he said, so it's basically like an advance to an author of a book, like the author gets a lump of cash to write the book. And then the book, if it sells, generates royalties. And I wasn't sure whether that was the right thing. That's a pretty simplistic, and possibly maybe authoring a book is a bit riskier than doing what you're doing.
Yeah, no, it's not hugely dissimilar. I mean, in that sense, it's really not dissimilar from what equity and debt are trying to do as well. They put down their upfront slug of capital, and then they expect a stream of cash flow to come back to them. you know, this is just a slightly different take on that, and has, you know, different risk profiles, and we think is sort of one of the ideal ways to play the sector, unless you're sort of prone to wanting to place bets on junior miners and you feel confident that you can pick the winners in that regard. Otherwise, the equity space is a bit risky, and debt, you know, you're sort of capping your upside in that regard. So royalties kind of have some of the best of both categories.
Yeah, when I asked you about the advantages of working for other people before you strike out on your own, I thought you were going to talk about contacts and know-how and building up some personal cash of your own. And we'll come on to that. But because most of my businesses are involved in technology, I wanted to ask about the impact of technological progress on the business case for doing what you do, because you alluded to a problem, which is that if you invest in a mine, then potentially the management can blow all the money they're making out of their mining operations on CapEx, on investments which don't yield a return. On the other hand, common sense and, you know, thousands of years of human history suggest that new technology always means that you can either do what you're already doing cheaper, or you can do things you couldn't do before, which in the case of a mine might mean that, in the case of mining in general, might mean that over time, miners get better at extracting the last drop of whatever it is, or the last ounce of whatever it is they're mining for. So over time, as mines get, technology makes mines more efficient, that's very attractive for people who've got a royalty deal, such as yourself. And do you see that as part of your case, that over time, the miners get better at extracting than they were at the time you invested?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the key considerations is where the actual mine that you're reviewing sits on the cost curve relative to its peers. So you don't want to be the highest cost iron ore mine, for example, because as soon as prices drop, you're the first one that has to shut their doors. So yeah, where you're positioned from a cost perspective is important. So yeah, I mean, the things like the fact that, well, in that particular case, our iron ore royalty, the fact that they're expanding production means that their fixed costs are now spread across more tons of production. And so they're now moving down the cost curve, and are becoming a lower cost producer than they would have been if they were producing half as much. So that's a really critical consideration. With regards to the technology side in mining, it's you'd be amazed at some of the technological advances. Some of the big mines in Australia in particular, you know, that they have autonomous trucks and dropping material into autonomous trains that take it straight to the port and are autonomously loaded into ships. And so, you know, they're finding ways to do things more safely, because then you don't have, fatigue from the miner, you know, the actual employees on the ground. But then, you know, they can just run 24/7 nonstop very efficiently. You can control you control your production with much more certainty. So that there's quite a bit that they're doing on that front. That's pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I one of my clients for another business I mentioned previously, the biggest Polish copper and silver mining conglomerate, KGHM. There was a European Union directive to do with tracking explosives. It's a very reasonable thing. I mean, people complain about regulation, but I think it's a highly desirable state of affairs that it's partly regulated. Yeah. But you know, this was a barcode system to keep track of all these very sensitive materials underground, and that was quite a successful project. And I was wondering, you know, you've mentioned Australia as sounding like it's a leader. Do you are there areas of the world where you feel, I don't know, they're ahead or behind, or is mining such a globalized industry that if you go to a modern mine, be it in Chile, America, Canada, or Australia, or somewhere in Europe or Russia, they'll be having pretty much the same technology these days?
It really depends on the size of the miner. I mean, Canada and Australia are the biggest mining jurisdictions and sort of lead the way with regards to technological advances and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, I've seen everything from some pretty advanced, really efficient sort of modern operations to still, things sort of bordering on the artisanal. So there's still a pretty wide gambit. Clearly the more you can get into sort of the well sort of oiled and operated operations, it just, not only from the miner's perspective, you have better cost control, the sort of financial metrics tend to look better, but it also tends to be, you know, more environmentally friendly and better for the employees, you know, that sort of thing. So I'd say in that regard, the mining industry's made some pretty leaps and bounds steps over the last sort of 20 years.
I'm just supposing there might be an entrepreneurial opportunity, a little like real estate, that if you're a well-run real estate company, you can see a great building being badly run in a good area. You can sort of turn it around in a way that, and perhaps there could be a badly run mine on a very good resource.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the opportunity there is to basically run it much better than the previous owners, who perhaps can get sort of sleepy and over it, depending on the ownership structure, might be making quite a lot of money just because the mine's so good rather than the way they're running it.
Yeah, that's right. You see that all the time where, you know, a mine that's been operating for 15, 20 years and still the same sort of equipment that's being held together with duct tape, so to speak, but and an operator that's just kind of milking it for cash, but a bit of investment would go a long way towards modernizing it and extracting more value ultimately. So there's a lot of opportunities like that. Other things you see is groups that go into particularly some of the African countries where there's a lot of artisanal miners and then they effectively, rather than have the artisanals run around and do things unsafely and potentially damaging to the environment, they'll train them in sort of best practices, and then they'll buy the material that they're mining from them. So in that sense, it's almost sort of a co-op type structure, but it institutes then some best practices with regards to how they operate and that sort of thing. And ultimately sort of benefits everybody and then makes for a sort of more efficient operation. There's quite a few examples of that sort of thing that happen.
Well, if anyone listening is looking for an opportunity and they haven't figured out what to do, they can call me or Adam. Who knows? There might be something out there. It just strikes me that this is, you know, these old historic. You mentioned that it's almost as old as humanity itself. That in an area like this, it can be very surprising if you're not close to it. Just how much more efficiently things can be done if latest technology is applied in the right way. And yeah. I wanted to come back to contacts and personal savings as part of the or contacts and know-how that you. I asked you where you found projects from previously, and it then became very apparent that it was your years of being in the business that were relevant. But if you were trying to sort of describe what are the sources of your leads of potential projects where you might provide capital in return for a royalty, how you get them and how you acquired the know-how and the contacts to make that possible.
Yeah, sure. And it's not just us as a management team. It's the board has contacts as well. And then we've got three advisory groups involved. Tamas's partners out of the UK, and then Azure and Ashanti Capital, both out of Australia. So they were instrumental, as you'd expect, in the fundraise. Probably worth flagging that they took their fee and shares, so they're also shareholders and are on board with the strategy. But they get a lot of opportunities across their desks, being resource focused advisors and brokers. So yeah, the iron ore royalty was sourced directly from our network and the management team, and then leaning on the advisors because they had some connections that could make the introductions for us. And then the copper one was one that came directly from the advisors because they were familiar with the asset and the management team and knew of the capital need there. They're coming in from sort of different directions. But fair to say, we're not short on opportunities between our networks and the advisory networks, and then just the standard conferences. You know, there's the EMEA Mines and Money conference going on this week. Taking sort of numerous meetings there and just keeping your finger on the pulse of the industry in general and making people know that you're out there as a potential source of capital. There's quite a few opportunities.
Okay, so conferences, very often people who don't realize what trade events are about, they go there thinking they're going to listen to interesting educational talks, and the real value is going on in conversations in the breaks. And, you know,
that's right. Yeah.
I did a training for a business I used to run 20 years ago, like getting the most out of trade events. I said, it's before, during, and afterwards. And if you show up at an event without a diary full of appointments, and even if you don't get the appointment, the fact you're going there gave you an excuse to cold call someone and say, I'm going to be there. Do you have time to meet? And people say, no, but send me an email. And you've got that contact for when it's relevant, even if they never met you. And it's that the fact you're both going to whatever it is, South by Southwest or whatever, it gives you an excuse to make that contact. Are you good at that? Are you sort of, have you got a sort of salesy salesy background where you're fine with cold calling total strangers if it's relevant to your business.
I'm not bashful. See, I don't mind cold calling people. I wouldn't sort of pitch myself as a salesman and by any means, but yeah, I don't mind reaching out to people. And part of the fun of conferences is that they tend to be a marathon. So when you get to go in person anyways, you know, it is the coffee breaks and then, you know, the drinks after the conference ends for the day that evolves into dinner and then, you know, that sort of thing. And from there you not only have a contact, but you've got sort of a friendly sort of acquaintance relationship where you can call them up and you understand them and they understand you. And that's really the sort of things that you can leverage. So yeah, I think while the virtual stuff isn't bad because you can still meet people and they're very efficient. You don't have to waste time traveling and checking into hotels and all that sort of thing. You do miss that sort of stuff outside the conference because it's not really necessarily the 30-minute meetings during the day that sort of open up the opportunities. It's the sort of stuff, you know, before and after and in between.
Yeah, totally. And I get there's a couple of really important lessons like that, which, you know, hopefully the COVID thing will be over in 6 or 9 or 12 months to the extent that people can get back to face-to-face meetings. But
yeah,
for B2B businesses where trust is really important, you can go so far on phone calls and Zooms and things, and it's impressive what you can do. And at the same time, you know, if you're investing millions and millions of dollars, whether it's in a deal like you do or you're just giving a contract to someone like an SAP implementation or whatever, where if you screw it up as a client, your job is on the line as well. You need to really trust those people.
That's right.
Because you know that it's tricky and it's difficult. So people like to do business with people they like. Making personal contacts is important, but also having the awareness that if you've got a reasonable offer, there's no reason not to pick up the phone and talk to someone for whom your offer is relevant. Because, you know, if you're a good company, you're doing them a favor, even if they say no, because they had the chance to consider your offer.
No, that's right. And even if they do say no, then, you know, that they know you're out there and they know what you do. And maybe it didn't work for them, but maybe it works for somebody else that they know and your name gets brought up. And now that's how it works.
Exactly. And there may be a point up to which you're not prepared to answer this, but you obviously had, you know, private equity, the salaries are fairly good. And did you save in order to be able to invest in this business? Or did you just like have a cushion to mean that, you know, I'm sure as a CEO, this isn't going to happen, or be like, everything could happen. You know, your office building could be hit by a jumbo jet with your entire team there. That do you feel that it's you need to have like your own personal capital to go down the route you did? Or do you think if you've got the right skills, you actually will find people to back you, even if you don't have any money to put in yourself?
I suppose it comes down to personal risk profile. I've got a family, three kids and a wife. And so for me, I'm very much all in on Trident. I'm a personal saver by nature. So, you know, I do sort of squirrel away, you know, as much as I can, but I wouldn't say it was with a direct aim of doing this specific thing. It was more with having in mind that I, you know, when the opportunity arises, I don't want to be handcuffed because, you know, I can't take a risk because I'm loaded up with personal debt or something like that. So now that's just my sort of personal philosophy was always to be able to position myself such that I can take advantage of opportunities.
So that I actually gave a TEDx talk last year about opportunity readiness, and I explained what I meant, and that it's like auditing yourself with the question, like, if an opportunity came along, are you ready? And one of the aspects was finance, but there was also, you know, are your relationships in good shape? Because if something, you need a needy boyfriend or, you know, jealous husband, you know, if they don't like you staying late at a coffee morning, what are they going to do if you go away on a 3-week business trip for the sake
of
having good support at home? But it's also stuff like your physical fitness and your personal health and, you know, or your level of education, that even if you don't know what you want to do or what your opportunity is going to be, you can work on being ready for it as of right now. And that, so that certainly makes a difference. And, you know, as an investor, I also was a little suspicious if someone had been working for McKinsey or Goldman Sachs for a few years and claimed they had no savings, because those companies pay pretty high salaries, and if you can't squirrel anything away while you're working for them, I'm not sure you're going to be looking after shareholders' money that carefully.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Not everyone's like that, but that's just a personal thing. So, and you mentioned there's a bit of competition, and you mentioned there isn't that much competition in the space you're in, and I'm not sure whether you told me or us in this conversation or earlier that one of the things that gave you the insight that this might be an opportunity was when you were on the other side of the deal trying to sell royalties, you had really attractive deals and there just weren't enough buyers out there.
Well, yeah, that's right. Yeah, when you look at the royalty space, it's dominated by precious metals focused royalty companies. And when you look at the sort of full spectrum of listed royalty companies, I think maybe there's 20 or so today. And of those, there's only two of us listed outside of North America. So you have this heavy concentration in North America in precious metals. When you're looking to monetize a royalty that's non-precious metals and not out in North America, there's really just not a natural home for it. So I certainly saw that when I was on the other side of the equation. And that's kind of like what got the gears churning was, you know, just it feels like, and fair to say that in the royalty space, if you rewind the clock, you know, maybe just 10 years, I think there'd probably be, you know, that 20 would be down to 3 or so, you know, so it's, and there's some big companies, you know, multi-billion dollar market cap royalty companies in the mining space. But that said, it's still an industry that's maybe classifies in its adolescence in the sense that there are still, you know, niches to be filled. The fact that there isn't sort of a big multi-billion dollar diversified mining royalty company, there's only precious metals focused ones, you know, centered in North America. Yeah, that struck us as very odd. And the fact that there isn't a natural home for a copper royalty that by and large, you know, you'd struggle potentially to sell that. Even though a dollar from a copper royalty is as good as a dollar from a gold royalty. Again, that just struck us as very strange. It left us sort of scratching our heads. So when the opportunity with Trident came along with the advisory guys that had set up the original vehicle, sort of thinking a similar stream of thoughts. It just made all the sense in the world to make a jump, make the jump and capitalize on that.
Yeah. So, and do you think that there are other walks of life where it's moving into, it started with precious metals in mining. And now thanks to the activities of yourself and, you know, you're not the only people in the world doing it. A few others, is spreading to other areas. Do you think there are other sort of sectors, I don't know, maybe where this, the same sort of thing could happen in the future? Because it's obviously you meet a certain need to raise finance that's not as onerous as debt and not diluted. I know the case seems to be quite strong. Can you see this spreading to other areas of the world economy in the long run?
Yeah, actually, there's a few listed in the U.S. and one I know of, Duke Royalties, listed on the AIM as well. Same board that we trade on. Now Duke is a non-mining focused, so they invest. I don't know them in very well, good detail, but I think they invest in sort of retail and pretty much anything else outside of sort of resources. At the end of the day, a royalty is a financial instrument. If there's a business that, you know, needs capital and is willing to give you a percentage of their revenue in exchange for some upfront capital, you can do a royalty. It's not specific to mining. It's maybe proliferated a bit more in mining, but as you mentioned a couple examples previously on, you know, movies and other sort of things where royalties are pretty common.
Yeah, I think I'd rather have a mining royalty than a retail royalty right now.
Probably. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, we're drawing to the close. Is there anything that I haven't asked you about I'll ask you one specific question about the longer term ambition. If it goes well and like you hit all your targets that your internal and external that you've set for yourselves or have been set, could you be doing this for 15, 20 years? Could you become a huge multi-billion dollar company like some of the big ones? Could that be your future? Or where do you see yourself taking this if it goes the way you really want it to go?
Yeah, so I mean, we definitely don't see ourselves as being capped in any way. I mean, I think ultimately what we'd want to do is, because I think we can extol the virtues of royalties and why they're a good way to get your mining exposure. And in an economy like today where governments are printing fiat currency as quickly as they can, having exposure to real assets is probably not a bad place to park some of your money. So I think And royalties are a great way to do that. So I think you can extol all the virtues. And then, as I said, there's just not a diversified miner to give you the broad spectrum of exposure to mining commodities. So what we'd want to do in the near-ish term is to build a portfolio that's broadly representative of the mining sector by commodity. So about a third precious metals, a third base metals, and a third bulk and battery minerals and everything else, which is roughly what the mining sector breakdown would be, so that a shareholder can have a single share of Trident and have exposure to the full breadth of mining commodities. So that's really the strategy. And then, you know, it's the kind of model that can really build on itself, because you're not operating a mine, so you don't need hundreds of employees. You know, Royal Gold here in town in Denver, they're a circa 8 billion market cap company, and, you know, sort of 25 to 35 people in that office, because they are financial instruments. You acquire one, you put it in your wallet, so to speak, you audit it and monitor the asset, but then you go out there and buy the next one, and you keep building your portfolio. So it's the kind of thing that can scale up without a commensurate scale up in G&A or expense. You know, we can maintain a relatively low cost business model, but still grow the value of the company. And then there's really no cap to that. I think it is only a matter of time, whether it's us or somebody else, that you'll have a multi-billion dollar diversified mining royalty company.
Mm-hmm. And what would be the sort of mistakes that, I suppose, someone listening to this who's maybe got more money than sense, and there are people in this world like that, some of them have very important jobs right now, someone might say this all sounds really great and they just plow in without really knowing what they're doing. What would be the biggest mistakes that you could imagine someone who gets the general idea but doesn't know the details? What are the risk areas in this? What can go wrong?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of mining operations that start up and then just fall right over. So yeah, that's where, you know, the team we've assembled is primarily mining finance professionals. So, you know, myself coming from mining private equity, where you're investing in mines and, you know, every continent around the world and across the breadth of commodities. And before that, in mining equity research, before that, working for Orica Mining. My colleague in Perth, he started as a metallurgist, and then did his master's of finance in CFA, and then worked in mining private equity as well. So, yeah, you know, it's having the sort of right mix of financial acumen and technical acumen, because there's no shortage of mining projects that need capital, but it's a matter of sort of picking the right ones. And so, you know, there's quite a bit of technical expertise, and it's not necessarily a matter of having it all in house. And there are consultants you can go to, but then from there, it's the matter of having a network to know who's the right consultant. If you're looking at a gold project in Mali, who's looked at that particular geology before that could give you support and give you sort of the minutia that maybe just a general consulting house couldn't provide you. So it gets pretty detailed when you burrow into the nuances of this business model. So it's not quite as easy as just sort of placing a few bets and hoping they go well.
Yeah, and certainly I think that that's a really important lesson, that it's not just being ready to bring in expertise, but it's having enough expertise to bring in the right expertise, because there are a lot,
right, yeah.
Just like there are dodgy miners who'll happily take your capital, there are probably even more dodgy consultants who will take your capital and give you bad advice, and a fool and their money are soon parted. Okay, well, just drawing to the close, is there anything that we haven't asked you or you haven't shared that you think someone who wanted to get your story and the Trident Resources, or as it will be called soon, Trident Royalty story, is there anything we haven't asked or any advice you'd like to share with someone thinking about possible things to do with their life that they could learn from you?
No, I'd encourage people to go to the website, and, you know, our corporate presentation's on there. My contact details are on there as well, so people can reach out if they have questions. I answer every email I get. So yeah, I'm of course happy to answer that. I'd encourage them to take a look at the company. We, you know, as mentioned, we jumped on board of a shell that was already listed and had a bit of cash in it. So then we did our relisting and IPO on AIM earlier, but just about a month ago. But we're effectively trading at cash despite having done two very accretive deals, because you get that instance where the shell shareholders that didn't originally sign up for a royalty company are exiting. So there's, I think, a bit of an opportunity for people to take a look at the stock as a potential shareholder. So I think, you know, it will be a matter of time before we re-rate, and some of the value of the royalties we're starting to acquire will be demonstrated. So yeah, I'd encourage people to take a look at the company, and if they have questions, certainly reach out.
Yeah, so I think this is the first time in the history of this podcast that we're going to end with a stock tip. and as a matter of fact, I've already invested. But the objective of this this podcast is not to pump the stock so that we can both dump it. Well, Adam, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. I will, when it goes live on the iTunes podcast app and so on, I'll certainly let you know, and we might collaborate a little bit to see where we could get it out to audiences we both want to reach, because this is an unusual content for me that we've never had a mining resources person. And if in the future you want to be in touch about anything, you're welcome to. So from me and the Project Kashmir's audience, I'd just like to say thank you very much and goodbye.
Yeah, great, thank you, appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Project Kashmir's, brought to you by me, your host, Richard Lucas. If you enjoyed listening, check out additional podcasts on our webpage, projectkashmir's.com, or on iTunes, where you can also subscribe so you never miss an episode, and also leave us a 5-star review if you feel like it. We welcome feedback and suggestions of new interviewees, whether as comments on projectkashmir's.com or via our page on Facebook. This podcast was produced by Adam Zuber. Thank you again for listening.
You know, vision is all great and well, but execution is actually the key.
The actual process of meeting those people, working with them, is in itself a huge reward.
Interaction between the university and the business and high tech community is absolutely fundamental.
Diversity creates a healthy ecosystem, and I think that I'm seeing more and more of that diversity. It's not just about individuals, but it's about new individuals, it's about, you know, new initiatives. Sometimes they overlap with each other, sometimes they might be cannibalizing each other, but the reality is that you want to have as many as possible, because that accelerates the big picture.
We're not going to have everyone in the world here, and in this connected world we don't need everyone here, but the, you know, the artists and the designers, the creators, they're very much part of what we've got and what we need. So if you're listening again somewhere else in the world and you feel you're looking for a place where your creative juices will run, then this city is certainly a place where you can find yourself.
And I think you can make history in Poland. I think you can be part of something much bigger than you could be a part of in the United States right now, not just from a, you know, going out to San Francisco to make Silicon Valley richer, but making a new part of the world grow at a much faster rate, be a much bigger part of that community, and making it wealthy, not just for wealth's sake, but for a purpose, which is to make that country's government stronger,